IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I'm your host, Carl Jason, from the Takshashila Institution. In today's episode, I've got a very special guest, Sudhanshu Kaushik. Now, Sudhanshu is an international youth activist and founder of the Young India Foundation and author of The Future Is Ours, The Political Promise of India's Youth. He has led YIF in empowering youth in politics, including initiatives registering over 2.5 million youth voters, lobbied with over 200 sitting MPs and 5 state governments to decrease the age to contest elections as an MP, MLA, and has also built the Center for Youth Policy. Thank you so much, Sudhanshu, for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, man. I've always wanted to ask, do you podcasters always have to say a very special guest? Is that the appropriate mannerisms?
No, I think it's for select guests only.
Go back to all your podcasts that you've hosted and just see how many times a special guest.
No, I can vouch for that. So, but really nice to have you. And we met at BIC. So I actually took time out, listeners, from a fairly busy Monday evening to actually go to BIC at the Bangalore International Center and listen into Sudhanshu's talk. I'm fairly interested in this topic. So why don't we get straight down to it, Sudhanshu? So your book, essentially, at its very heart, is a really passionate call to lower the age of candidacy, right, from 25 to 21. And you also delve into a host of other issues related to this. And you also try to keep this campaign neutral to, let's say, a political party. So it covers all sides of the spectrum. And the intention being that you will bring a huge number of India's young directly into the democratic sort of process. So could we start off by maybe telling us a little bit about why do you think there hasn't been any legislative action formulated for young people in India despite the increased presence, right, of younger individuals within the proximity of power? And I quote your article where you said that, there are a lot more young people now working with, say, ministers and ministers' offices, etc. So why do you think there has been no legislative action so far?
Yeah, just to give context about the book as well, I don't think this is necessarily a policy book, other than at the end where there's the appeal for what I believe would ensure greater representation of young people in parliament, or one of the more concrete methods to do so. It's a context-setting book. It's not a narrative or an interview style or even, the usual kind of youth-centric books that come out. It's not meant to be that. It's meant to just give context, because I felt that when we as Indians, whether it's young people, stakeholders, media, politicians, policy representatives, we talk about young people, and especially through the perspective of policy and politics. Of course, they're as beneficiaries of those policies, but we don't do justice to kind of really looking into the demographics, the details. Maybe I'm wrong, Carl, but I just feel that we have this general tendency to put a broad range variables, factors for this quote-unquote word youth or young without really looking into the details. And then our go-to kind of, caveats or issues that they're facing, unemployment, skill building, and then the conversation just swings to, but the world's largest labor force and youth demographic dividend, etc. And outside of that, there are very limited conversations. So my attempt was to kind of give context to, okay, what exactly is a youth and young? How media, even policy professionals, are perverting those words and propagating a false narrative about who and what is a youth or a young in person in India, and how that not just disenfranchises us, but in terms of just equity, really puts us on a back foot as a youth demographic. And then obviously give more context when you purely look at it from a political perspective, giving assessments on parties. I mean, we're thinking about, and there's conversations about how a certain party does this, how a certain party does that. Mm. But when it comes to parties platforming young people or giving nominations or, you know, getting them to positions of power, it's like this general broad, they're worse. For example, you know, we'll say, oh, young people under the age of 50, right? And I'm just like, wait, I'm sorry, what? I mean, you know, 50-year-old politicians there are that are being called young have kids as old as me in some cases. So I'm just, I think that was the context setting that I wanted to give for my reasoning of why I wanted to write this book. And of course, the ending is about, you know, this policy change that I'm advocating for, which I, you know, rightfully or wrongfully believe will help increasing greater representation by decreasing the age. When it comes to, you know, why hasn't there been a larger kind of policy for young people? First of all, I think that's inaccurate. There has been in the late 80s when the 61st Amendment came in and we decreased the voting age from 21 to 18. One unfortunate thing is that, you know, it's not talked about enough. The voting age itself. It's just something that we take for granted right now. And one of the chapters in the book actually breaks down the 61st Amendment. I do two or three things. One is talk about the context and how at that time, a lot of people were out on the streets saying this is going to ruin the country. This is going to, you know, too much inexperience, too much immaturity. The same kind of excuses we see today about any other youth legislation that we want to bring up. The second thing was to also give political context of what was happening, how this was a big demand since very early on, and give kind of what these politicians and what they spoke about and what their perspective about youth was, positive and negative, in the debates. And also to give justice to the unheard actors. Right now, what happens is that when we talk about the 61st Amendment, this voting aspect, we tend to rush to give all the benefit to the current the Prime Minister of that time, Rajiv Gandhi. And sure, you know, the government was in a majority; they had, you know, the power. They introduced it. They got it passed through. But it's ridiculous that we don't talk enough about how they sat on it for 3.5-4 years. Yep. The intention was to actually not pass it. But because of a coalition of southern regional leaders and some national figures of that time from the opposition, mainly Tamil Nadu, MGR, Karnataka, in some cases, and also Andhra Pradesh, where we saw basically, you know, a film star come into power for the first time with the DDP. What was happening is that, you know, there were, I'm not sure if I would label it as more progressive, but I think they understood young people a little bit more. And they were able to really push the government. You know, when the Third Front was being created, and not a lot of people talk about this at that time, I think what a big push there was also that this, you know, we need to decrease the voting age. We need to decrease the voting age. We need to get more young people out there. And they did a coalition of rallies across India, South, obviously, but also North. They got at that time the Chief Minister of Haryana, Devi Lal, to also come in. At that time, Atal Bihari Vajpayee and Alka Advani were kind of the voices of the of kind of at a national level in the Hindi belt as well, and they all kind of came together to force the government to be like, "Hey, you need to implement this. You need to put this back on conversations." And one of the really alarming things is that you found the Rajiv Gandhi kind of government in the back foot, because at that time they sat on it. And then basically what happened was is local state governments started passing it. So Karnataka was the first state in the union to pass the decrease of the voting age in the municipality and panchayats at that level. Then, you know, then you had kind of Tamil Nadu and West Bengal. And when they introduced it in West Bengal, the sitting law minister in the union government hailed from West Bengal, and he, you know, basically, I'm sorry, the law minister, but the sitting MP was a West Bengal, you know, Congress president, filed a case in the state, a high court of West Bengal, to make it impossible for West Bengal to do this, right? So this is this kind of duplicity that we saw. So A, there has been, you know, that one legislation that I think really was, in terms of the larger framework of youth rights, monumental. Has it been to the extreme of other countries, whether it's, you know, decreasing the age of candidacy or even decreasing the voting age or having kind of more of a say in policy? No, right? India kind of lacks in that. And I guess why there is I feel like, you know, we're an ageist society. We discriminate on the basis of age all across. And I think you see it a little bit more societally kind of ingrained in India. I've split my time between India and the United States. So I've seen it very clearly in that case. And look, I mean, the United States has equal, if not more, amount of problems. But you do see ageism, especially at a younger age that's coming in.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
Yeah, no, Sanju, I just wanted to come here, you know, because this the topic of ageism, right? And it's not a central debate in your book, but you very cleverly tried to say maybe sidestep the issue of being maybe called an ageist by, let's say, asking to lower the age from 25 to 21. But that's not you. That's not what you intend to do. Your larger point, of course, is that, you know, young people are often scapegoated and trivialized, you know, for their age, supposedly seeming to lack maturity and experience, right, to be able to take a political sort of office. But you have quoted studies like the one by the Center for the CSDS, Center for the Study of Developing Societies, that through the access to media and technology, we've actually seen an exponential increase in political awareness, right, and interest among the youth. So how do you think this challenges like, you know, the prevailing perception, right, of political apathy, of disinterest among young public? And what insights do this give you for youth engagement in politics?
So one thing is, you know, you don't need to quote any study to understand that young people are political and everything around us is political, from the people we love to the people, you know, the songs that we like, to the people we surround ourselves, to whatever we are. I mean, whatever is most accessible to us, we will, right? You know, our Instagram algorithm, even at that point, is our digital rights, our privacy is political, right? It just, the nuances is what is more accessible to us and what is not accessible to us. If I can, you know, if I know Raghav Chadha and Parineeti Chopra's wedding is happening, it's because, and where they're going to a honeymoon, it was because my algorithm was just feeding me that content. It was so accessible all the time, or the recent Ambani wedding and who's dancing where, right? It's unfair to kind of scapegoat young people and say, oh, you know, there's so much political apathy, you young people don't care. No, I mean, we are very vocal about, again, the people we can love. We're very vocal about the music that we listen to. We're very vocal about our jobs, our opportunities, our education. And no, the answer is not that we're going out and standing for elections or even in some cases going out and vote, but we're expressing our minds online where we face, we won't, you know, kind of foresee any kind of this kind of clamp down. And obviously that's a concern in itself, but I don't think necessarily that there is there's a reason for that political apathy, and that's inaccessibility. I mean, India, we love to say, is the world's largest democracy, but it's also one of the most complicated voting processes. Three steps, right? You have to obviously register, which in itself takes 30, 40 minutes. Then you have to do basically identification authorization by self-attesting. I mean, who self-attests right now? Like, you have to literally print, scan, and sign and then submit. And then obviously the address verification. In the US or in the European countries, literally, if I'm getting any other identification, whether it's my, you know, tax ID or whether it's my driver's license, I just have to click a check mark and say, hey, I want to be registered to vote as well. And I'm registered. I'm on in the address of where it is. And accessibility, and I could talk about this, is that people also don't know their voting rights. I mean, it's interesting we talk about India being the world's largest democracy again, but I do think we have a lot of voter suppression. Maybe not like targeted voter suppression, but within our policies, within the jumble of policies, inadvertently, we have voter suppression. And what I mean by that is young people don't know, or even politicians don't know, actually, stakeholders don't know that, you know, young people should be allowed to vote wherever they are. And the Election Commission wants that. And some, you know, stakeholder will call that carpetbagging, right? But the sheer reality is when we talk about the migrant vote, we generalize to just say, you know, people from Bihar and Jharkhand. That's the generalization that we give. But the migrant vote is also the student vote. It's also the young professional vote. I mean, they are coming to either study or work far from their state of domicile, etc. And the Election Commission of India clearly says and actually tries to promote that, look, you're going to be studying in Manipal Institute for 4 to 5 years now, right? In the middle of Mangalore. There's no way you're going to fly back to, let's say, you know, Haryana, which is my state of domicile, to study. There's absolutely no way you're going to be able to afford a 20,000 ticket and you don't know at the day of, because, you know, elections are not like, oh, set and we don't know the dates beforehand, etc. So they're like, you should vote where you study. Because you're studying there, you're paying tuition there, you're paying taxes in some cases, you're, you know, going and taking an Uber, you're eating out, you're going out, that sort of stuff. All of this, you're paying rent. All of this is at that local economy, right? So ECI says you should, and I agree with that. Where you're studying, where you're working, where you're living is where you should be allowed to at least participate. And as we get into more centralized elections, let's be honest, if someone's going to tell you and say, oh, your local candidates, I mean, we're voting on national level issues, especially for an MP level, right? So what the ECI says is there's this Annexure 4.1 that if you're a student specifically, all you need is your university registrar to sign the form and to attest that, yes, you are a student, and your voter ID, whether you're registered in Delhi or you're a first-time voter, will be registered in the university and in which the parliamentary constituency or the assembly constituency or even the panchayat or municipality it's in. And that's accessibility. But people don't know that. And I mean, I'm talking about politicians themselves don't know that for right or wrong reasons. Stakeholders, people that are self-professed youth experts don't know that. And that's kind of disappointing. And that's also kind of maybe an accessibility issue where we're getting in the way of not letting that kind of commonality be known and making it easier to be able to register to vote, to get that out there. And when we talk about, you know, youth votes, so we estimate at the Center for Youth Policy using kind of ECI numbers that there might be over 90 million or no crore people between 18 and 30 who aren't registered to vote. And that's a huge number. That's basically the number of, I think, like the entire German state. How do we really reach out to them? And the question then comes back is not because it's, I believe, you know, youth voter apathy. That's scapegoating the blame. I think it's about accessibility. You make things easier. I mean, from our PAN to our Aadhaar to, I don't even have to take out any identification from my phone to go into an airport to board a flight. And yet, you know, I still can't even register to vote without all this complicated process, let alone just voting. So it's about accessibility.
Yeah, no, I think you brilliantly highlight this in the book, and I strongly urge our listeners to pick up a copy to actually get into some of the details of this. We don't want to give too much away, don't we, Sudhanshu? So,
just to say, Carl, the reason you don't want to give too much away because it's a short book, and I've said that it's made very accessible. I want people to be talking about it, lots of charts and graphs, and again, it's not about policy, but rather just making this conversation about youth and politics. So the reason Carl can't say much about it is because it's a very short and simple read. So if he says everything, you'll know everything about the book. But that doesn't mean that, you know, it's a conversation starter about specifically youth and politics, and not just generalizations of a 50-year-old politician and calling them a next generation leader.
So to maybe wrap up, we are looking forward to the 2024 general elections, and your commentary in the media has been about how parties are trying to revamp their methods, and no less, you know, the Prime Minister himself. So how do you think parties have, like, you know, revamp their strategy to attract, you know, this audience? Because you often argue that there's going to be a new voter, like in the coming elections, right? And this is pertinent for any party looking to sort of attract their attention. So what do you think are some of those methods that parties have adopted to reach out to these young voters? You have YouTubers and Instagram influencers who have joined the bandwagon. But what else do you think parties are sort of up to?
Yeah, and just to give context to that question, because I think it's super, super important. So sure, there's always been an analysis / media reporting on what the youth thinks, right? They try to make it sound really sexy, but it's just like, oh, what do you think about this leader? Or what do you think about jobs, etc. It's a very, you know, bare knuckle kind of like this, that, whatever, without too much of an assessment. Even like the surveys that we regard as kind of like the premier ones are limited to basically like a 2,000, 3,000 sample size survey, sometimes even 400 or 500 that we've gone through. So one is, here's a sheer reality, Carl, that the 17th Lok Sabha was the oldest elected Lok Sabha in the history of independent India to be elected by the youngest electorate. Around 80 million or 8 crore first-time voters came out to vote in the 2019 elections. First-time voters that the ECI classifies to 18 and 19-year-olds came out to vote. You might have a few, you know, kind of people that came out as well, but first-time voters, ECI classifies, around 80 million in 2019. Now, right now, there's an estimation that about 220 million voters between 18 and 30 could come out to vote in 2024, on top of that 90 million that I was talking about that are unregistered. So what you're looking at is basically a 300 or 30 crore vote bank that is between the ages of 18 and 30. And I'm just going to label that as kind of the youth aspect,
as
the voting, the youth age, I'm sorry, is 15 to 29 in India. It's 15 to 24 in international aspects. But below the age of 30, I'm just going to label that as the youth vote for this conversation. 300 million or 30 crore is the entire population of the United States, which is the third most populous country in the world.
Yeah, I mean, so it's a glaring gap. Yeah.
When we talk about the youth vote, it is the most consequential in India. Now, what's interesting is that before this, political parties really didn't target the youth vote as much. It wasn't as sexy, but also there was this preconceived notion that the young people will vote according to their parents, according to society, and that still stands to some degree. I'm not going to discredit that. So there wasn't necessarily an impetus to for a political party to go out there. Now, what I think the current government in power and the ruling party, what I think they've caught on to is something really interesting, which I've been advocating for a very long time, is that this youth vote and this vote bank, one, is the most independent it's ever been, right? We are statistically, as a youth demographic, more independent, not just in our thought, but in our, not just in our expressions, but also even in our livelihoods, in the way we the work, live, etc., from our parents. One, so that also, you know, that distance, etc., helps with the independence of thought, and you know, it's a residual effect. Then the second thing is that this is also a vote bank that necessarily does not belong to someone. I think in 2014 and 2019, from what the limited data that I understand, is that the prime minister was able to get a lot of votes from different parties and transferred them to him and his party in that way. I think what he's trying to do here is different. He's trying to bring people who have never come out to vote, primarily the young. I mean, and there's also a focus of women, but I'm not an expert on kind of the female kind of turnout, etc. So I'm talking about just youth. And this is kind of like the 2008 assessment of Barack Obama's campaign and how he won. He was able to build a coalition of, let's say, African Americans and Latinos who never were part of the system. And the landslide of victory that wasn't really necessarily assessed was because surveyors didn't really, you know, ask them or reach out to them. And so they weren't able to really describe and kind of understand the catalytic kind of effect that his campaign would have and turn out. And I think in that same aspect, I think Prime Minister Modi is actually reaching out to a youth vote that necessarily isn't part of the system yet or hasn't, and they're taking that calculated risk to do so. And I think that's really fascinating. And so basically what they're doing, and what you'll see, Carl, in the past 2 months itself, the Prime Minister has done about 18 events that are just youth focused. So like you rightfully said, yes, the government, they're reaching out with content influencer and creators. They've created this National Creator Summit, which will awards, which will release on Friday. And the Prime Minister himself will be awarding young creators in different categories. So that's kind of the campaigning purpose. But what you see here, and what's really fascinating with the BJP itself, is that they've done specific outreach campaigns at a national and then at a local level to the youth. And the Prime Minister has spearheaded it. So with the BJYM, they gave the Namo Navdata, where they're registering 18 to 25-year-olds and also helping them kind of, hey, like, this is the guy you want to be voting for, right? So a very youth-focused driven campaign. It's not just as simple as, oh, one page of their entire manifesto, they're going to be talking about youth, or the youth is talked about in the other aspects of it. No, these are very specific events. So for example, Prime Minister Modi has done in the past 2-3 months, 2 to 3 student-centric events where he's talking vaccination, stress, etc., calling all these students in. Then what he's also doing, and for National Voters Day that happened in January, he focused on youth vote and launching them and that, etc. But it's not just part of that. So in Parliament, in his last speech, he was using Gen Z language. He was talking about woke and cancel culture.
This. Yeah.
and even more, if you looked at the inside of it. If you looked at the actual speech, there was a huge focus on youth that he kept coming back to. And lastly, even in the BJP National Convention, the Prime Minister started his speech with, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but he basically says, on the 18th of February, I have the honor to speak to all the 18-year-olds who will be electing the 18th Lok Sabha. Imagine that, right? And that's a first thing he starts with, the first sentence he starts with. So I think there is a big, big intent by his team, by the party, whatever it is, to really focus and bring these people into voting, because I think they've kind of exhausted who they could, get the vote out from other parties, right? And so they've realized that if they can bring this fold, it'll increase their vote. And like I said, I mean, 90 million itself are not registered, 220 million are, registered, etc. But we don't know exactly how much voter turnout there will be, because the ECI doesn't break down age demographics. But let's just say, let's just take a generalization that 60% already do, 40% are remaining. So you're thinking about roughly what, 170, 180, 200 million still, around that, number, that are still not coming out to vote, that could. And that, tilts the game heavily to any side. So it's a super calculated approach that I'm really excited to see how it happens. And I'm not going to say, okay, this is a game changer. This is the first time ever. No one else is doing it. With the full intent, no one else is doing it. With this kind of really thought out approach, no one else is doing it other than the Prime Minister. But you see, what you see is like he moves the needle and then other people do it. And I think actually... And whether it's, if you've seen the party Instagram using memes, and it's not that the BJP did this. Actually, the Aam Aadmi Party in 2013, 2014, 2015 were so bootstrapped. They actually like really perfected the social media outreach using memes and using all that from when you remember Wagon R and the Muffler Man memes, all those sort of things. So I won't give credit to the BJP there. But what I think they really deserve credit for is really making youth into that, voter bank, and really targeting it with all energies towards them. And I think it'll give them dividends for sure. And that doesn't mean no other party is doing it, but there's such a big gap. There's such a big disparity. And I'm really excited to see how, for example, regional parties do it. I think they would have a much larger effect and outreach to youth vote, but are they doing it? No. I mean, the conversation, look, I don't know if you remember, but the conversation about youth vote from 2009, 2012, wasn't necessarily even targeting it. Is, someone wears jeans with his kurtas, or someone has an iPad in his hand, so that, means he's techie and young people. This is the first time, I think, in 2024, that you're using all variables, whether it's outreach to content creators, whether it's, changing your party platform, whether it's doing campaigns specific to young people to reach out to the youth vote.
Yeah. Thanks for that insight, Sudhanshu. I think, as you pointed out, I mean, it would be interesting to see how the youth vote translates in the upcoming elections. And as you pointed out, there's been a concerted effort by political parties, both national and regional for that matter, to attract this particular audience. Thanks so much for your time, Sudhanshu. I hope to have you for another episode. And here's a clarion call to all our listeners to pick up the book. As Sudhanshu said, it's a very short read. And yeah, I hope to sort of have a conversation with him maybe after the elections.
Not just pick up a book, but also go vote or register to vote, because there's time. That's right. There's enough time. Do not let anyone else tell you that it's not enough time. And yeah, go out, read the book, and also vote.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Sudhanshu.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.